You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good morning. Good morning. Wow, I walked in, it was very quiet in here, and so folks are ready to participate. Greetings, everyone. My name is Sean Dove, and I'm the campaign manager for the Open Society Institute's campaign for Black Male Achievement. We are really excited about this morning, and we welcome each and every one of you. And my role is to be very brief, welcome you, because we have an exciting panel to talk about a very important critical topic today. And I just want to thank the CBMA team, Georgia Kirkland. I don't know if she's in the room. She might be. Okay, let's all give Georgia a round of applause. I felt really bad for Georgia when I walked in this morning and there was a mob scene around the table, but you were handling it with grace and really cool, so thank you for that. And I just want to also firstly go back and just thank the Open Society Institute leadership, Ann Bess, who is the executive director, Rakiba Labrie, who is the fund director for the Equality and Opportunity Fund, who is not here in person, but certainly here in spirit. And we all know that nothing gets done without leadership, right? We can get an amen. Is Reverend Alfonso White in the house? We can get an amen. I thought I saw him. And I really want to acknowledge the program officer for the campaign, Brother Rashid Shabazz. Let's give Rashid a round of applause. Rashid joined the campaign staff sometime in early spring and literally hit the ground running. One day he came into my office with 15 things he wanted to put on my to-do list and another 10 that he had just completed. And I'm like, yo, what's up? And he said, I am on the Obama 100 days. And that's how I'm approaching this. I don't know if you've reached your 100 days yet.
August 9th.
August 9th? He's serious. And I've been thinking, like, when is his 100 days going to happen? Because he has been pushing the envelope. And while I'm the campaign manager and strategic communications has always been from the outset of this campaign a central goal, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But when Rashid hit the ground here, he has a background in calling around communications. He really raised the bar. And so what we have today is really a testament of his vision, his leadership, and his pushing the envelope in his 100 days. So thank you, Rashid. Now, many of you may recall about 3 years ago this spring, there was a front page article in the New York Times that read, "The Plight of Black Men Deepens." We remember that article? I think I still have emails in my inbox from folks flooding my email about this article. And the article raised many alarming statistics and scenarios that many of us who are working on the front lines in our communities and working with black men and boys, we were like, well, we know this. But what it did, and we have the author of that article here today, Eric Ekholm, to be a part of our panel, but what that article did was really heighten awareness in the philanthropic community around the crisis of black men and boys. And around that time, that article spurred a conversation right here in the halls of the Open Society Institute and on a board level and on a staff level, and the conversation was such, if OSI is a risk-taking, progressive philanthropy, what are we going to do about this issue? And part of the argument was, well, just inherently in our grant-making and the work that we are doing, we are supporting black men and boys. But someone voiced that we need to look at black men and boys and support black men and boys outside of a criminal justice framework. And I don't think he's here to yet, but Alvin Starks is on the guest list. He was a staff member here, and he, along with Erlen Ebrek, Rakiba Labrie, and a few other staff members, really pushed the envelope from a staff level and swayed the board to make a commitment. And in November of 2007, the board made a $15 million commitment. Think big now. $15 million commitment, although we know that that's not big enough, right? And so it's a three-year cross-fund initiative to really be a catalyst in the field of philanthropy of reversing the negative outcomes that we are seeing daily with black men and boys. And we've just emerged from a strategic planning process, and we have a couple core goals, and I just want to share them with you so you know what the campaign is trying to do, not will do, over the next 5 years. Our first goal is to strengthen low-income black families through responsible fatherhood initiatives, policy advocacy, and supporting efforts that lift barriers facing single mothers raising black boys. We know that a core foundation is strengthening families, and we're going to be doing a good deal of grant making and leadership in that area. Education is another core area. Ensure that black boys have the opportunity to excel academically, to prepare for college, to learn skills essential to earning a living wage. Three, expand and ensure 21st century family supportive wage. We cannot talk about black male achievement without talking about education and work. The fourth goal is to serve as a catalyst in the field of philanthropy for leveraging additional dollars. And while we're devoting $15 million, we know that the true value and importance and impact of this campaign is through strategic partnerships and the dollars that we can leverage both privately and publicly to this critical issue. And this is more than a campaign. What's needed is a generational commitment. And that's what we're helping to fuel. This is not new work. A lot of this work has been going on for years, and we've just launched this campaign at a time to add momentum. And the fifth goal is to integrate strategic communications into the campaign's core foundational areas to increase public awareness and promote positive frames and messages about black men and boys. And that's why we are here today. This meeting today is our mission in action. We said this is a call to philanthropy, right, Rasheed? This is a call to philanthropy, a call to action. And there are three things I just want to share that I know that philanthropy can do. And I know after today, this list is going to grow. And before I go any further, I'm looking around the room, and we have a lineup of distinguished panelists. But I'm looking around the room, and virtually everyone I'm looking at can be on this panel today. There's leadership throughout this room here, and I'm just so excited about the turnout at 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning around this issue. But we're committed to leveraging our ability to convene and bring individuals together for exactly what we're doing today, to convene, and keep this conversation at the center of this issue. So this is just not an event. This is part of our overall strategy. Number two is grant making. Funding organizations that are involved in innovative media. Something that I've always talked about since I've got here is how do we help black men and boys become masters of their own media, to tell their own stories, to report their own stories. And the last thing is what we need to have is courageous leadership. And there's a lot of courageous leadership in this room. And I wanted to share one thing that is kind of a precursor of this work that we're embarking upon. This is a book, it's called Be a Father to Your Child, Real Talk from Black Men on Family, Love, and Fatherhood. It was edited by April R. Silver, but Lauren Harris, while he was at the Ford Foundation, had the bold vision and the courage to make this happen at Ford. And it could have been a scenario where, well, maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe there was some pushback, but he had courageous leadership to make this happen. And what this book does, it shows us that black men are often portrayed as pimps, players, pushers, perpetrators, but we are actually proud papas, and we care about our fathers. So I want to share this book here that we have. And the last thing around courageous leadership, I had mentioned that this book is edited by April Silver. And just recently, how many of you are on Facebook? And I don't know if you received April's essay on Facebook, where she wrote a pointed response to the BET Awards performance by Lil Wayne. Who was the other person? We don't even want to give the prop the name. But she wrote a really pointed essay, and the essay went viral on the internet. Folks started writing in to BET, and they issued an apology. It was after the fact. Somebody had to see something like this was going to happen. But that's the power of courageous leadership. And at the same time, in the fall, the 21st Century Foundation, through a partnership with BET, right, Sean Morin, is going to be airing Bring Your A-Game. And what I'm encouraging us to do, just as we responded to the negative presentation that BET put forward, I am encouraging everyone in this room when Bring Your A-Game airs. What's that date?
September 12th.
What time?
9
p.m. Set the TiVo now to write in, email in, and let them know that this is the kind of media representation that we want. So we need to respond to that. So I am going to end by saying once again that this is more than an event, that this is part of our strategy, and we are going to get this show on the road. Are we ready?
Yes, sir.
Are we ready?
Yes, sir.
All right. Question is, am I ready? Do I have the bios? I know you gave me the bios, Rashid. You know, there are many days and many meetings when Rashid just comes through and you don't have it. All right. What we're going to do then, we are going to improvise. Recently, we had a Soros Justice Fellowship conference in Chicago. And a part of that event, there were two spoken word artists, Deja Taylor and FM Supreme. And when Rashid and the other folks from the OSI team came back to New York City, they were talking about what a fantastic conference it was. And Adam Colbreth, who's in the back, raise your hand, Adam. He is the program officer for the Justice Fellowship. And we just heard how powerful these two sisters were. And Rashid, in his 100-day manner, came in to my office and said, we are flying them in from Chicago, and they are being a part of this really critical event. And I said, of course we are. So I would like to invite Deja Taylor and FM Supreme to kick the morning off with their spoken word. Where are they? Oh, all right, come on now. A little round of applause.
C-O-M-M-O-N. It's the wealth we put it down. C-Dub is the emblem, and them blowing from Chi-Town. There's justice in the court. We ignore all of these clowns. Just trying to get it the best way that we know how.
Just trying to get it the best way I can. I'm on a mission by myself. Forget Uncle Sam. I mastermind the plan. Now I'm a superwoman. Man said I'm just trying to get it the best way I can. Star boy call. Now I'm flying on this spaceship. Need a facelift, my gumbo. Gotta make it. Ugochi said we can make it. Grew up now, of course I'm changing. Now I'm aiming for the pages of history. You gonna remember me when it's all said and done. I'm making history. I'm a prodigy living in these streets, and I wrote real well so they notice me. And my poetry represents the sea, and I orchestrate this like a symphony. And this ain't a myth, this is meant for me. My destiny is how it's supposed to be.
C-O-M-M-O-N, it's the wealth we put it down.
Town.
C-Dub is the emblem, and them blowing from Chi-Town.
Town is
justice in the court, we do ignore all of these clowns.
Clowns
just trying to get it the best way we know.
Trying to get me to get the best way
we know.
I'm on the mission by myself to get
way we know.
I'm
how.
At the master plan, now I'm a super
way
man.
We know
I'm just
how.
Trying to get the best way I can. Don't know how to do, you just know how to do
me.
I rock that black label and they rock that white
tee.
I never lose, but I've never been
low key.
I put it down
low key,
a little feisty
low key.
They wanna fight me getting hypey, but they scared to really try me. They wanna battle too timid, cause Asia right beside me. We pull it down, round for round, Shat City got the crown, and I was college bound. All these other rappers simple, I'm just praying for what change in hip-hop.
It's
my
love,
and I'm meant to kinda twist it.
I'm tired of getting twisted.
I'm ready to get lifted. It's time to pay attention. I'm going on a mission. Don't believe in superstition,
just trust in my intuition. I'm what the game's missing, C-O-M-M-O-N, it's the wealth we put it down.
Town.
C-Dub is the emblem, and them blowing from Chi-Town.
Town.
There's justice in the court, we do ignore all of these clowns.
Clowns
just trying to get it
the best way we know.
Trying
how.
To just get it, get the best way,
way
I can. I'm
how.
On the mission by myself to get
way we know.
I'm
how.
At the plan, I'm a super
way
man.
We know.
I'm
how.
Just trying to get it, get
we
the
are.
Best
we are broadcasting live from the city of wind. The realest women in the room, and they don't pretend no lie.
Not get it.
It's Commonwealth.
It's Commonwealth.
P.S. is Commonwealth.
Come on, come on. We can do, give it up. I'm just envisioning someone getting off the elevator, walking to their desk, and coming by the conference room like, what is happening here in OSI? FM Supreme, where's FM Supreme? Let's give her a round of applause. From Chicago. And Deidre Taylor, please don't leave here without making a contact for your next booking. Your next contract, we may be able to have something for you in New York before you, how long are you going to be in town?
Friday morning.
So Friday morning? All right. Somebody get them something to do tonight. I said earlier that nothing happens without leadership, and I also want to add that nothing happens without partnerships. And this has been a partnership in shared vision with Fenton Communications. And Rashid was at Fenton Communications, a senior account executive before he joined here. And one of his colleagues, Robert Perez, was a senior vice president. The two of them got together. Rashid was working on a project, and he was able to, as only Rashid can do, masterfully blend his unfinished work here and start something here in a wonderful way. And so I want to introduce Robert Perez, who Rashid told me that you were on a 100-day mold for like 3 years there. So the truth is out. And Robert, he leads the branding and messaging practice in Fenton's San Francisco office and is also a member of the firm's environmental practice. He has more than 14 years of experience in nonprofit and political communications and also has a strong background in grassroots organizing and legislative advocacy. He currently serves as a senior consultant to One Nation, a funding collaborative focused on providing a rich and accurate understanding of the American Muslim community. For those of you who do not know, Fenton Communications is a public interest communications firm focusing and supporting the work of the not-for-profit sector and the philanthropic sector as well. So I would like to invite Robert and Rashid to put this day morning in further context and introduce the panelists.
Before that, I'm going to ask Deja if she would do one more.
My name is Deja Taylor, and a poet is one of the things I am. I was recently featured on Russell Simmons' show, Brave New Voices, and I got to represent my city on the Chicago All-Stars poetry team. And I'm a strong believer in the urgency of movement, and so I think that one of the benefits of being a young person is I can say really whatever I want. Which is the truth, and I think the truth in a youth package is one of the most current events you can get. So with that, this poem is titled Numb to It. Little black boy, what you wanna be when you grow up? Young black man, now what you want to grow old for? Pow! Pow! Breaking news. Two black males have been shot and killed. CNN's theme song becomes a relaxing score of unurgent climaxes. Violence don't make us wet like it used to. This is what happens when we get used to life and get rough. The type of nonchalance depicts several photos of black so-and-so in our heads. Like 13-year-old so-and-so shot on Monday, 15-year-old so-and-so on Tuesday. The crime scene flashes on our screen, yellowed with caution tape. Exhibit A, what a black boy's face looks like when a 357 Magnum blows it inside. Pow, out. Exhibit B, the revolving chamber circles like a Ferris wheel. Gunpowder sugars the funnel cake. Exhibit C, someone has to scoop up all that imagination and adventure from the sidewalk before it stains. This circus of a city I'm from loves pink elephants. Breaking news, two black males have been shot and killed. On the front of every magazine cover, photoshopped and sharecropped black faces, tributes, somebody's airing a special. Since when do we care about cars banging that riffraff music at red lights, clenched fists, do-rags under a fitted? Do we care if he and his family are blown away? Pow, by his own gun. Pow, body tagged in a morgue. Face doing that brown to blue thing. The hardest niggas have rigor on the slab. Like 7-year-old so-and-so rolled in last Wednesday. 29-year-old so-and-so last Thursday. Friday, between 8 and 9 a.m., police say someone brutally gunned down Jennifer Hutton's mother and brother in their Chicago home. Jennifer Hutton's nephew is still missing. Update, police have found an SUV with the young body of a boy inside. Media romanticizes homicide. Mama Hutson, brother Hutson, nephew Hutson, slain Montague. The real Capulet capitalists keep the stage lit. The only weapons being loaded ain't just guns. They load their cameras. Journalists want to be Shakespeare, finessing a misfortune. But ain't nothing pretty about the inside of a bullet wound. Ain't nothing more Hollywood than a carpet made red by mama blood, brother blood, nephew blood. Junglist lost in Inglewood. Little black boy, what you wanna be when you grow up? Young black man, now what you wanna grow old for?
personification of health, Mr. Christie.
Good. Who was that lady I saw you with this afternoon?
That was no lady. That was my wife.
Dreaming how pretty I was going to look tonight. Well, here's my punishment for thinking so well of myself.
This is tough to put on. Can't take off. You know you're lucky.
Chicken house?
Uh-huh.
What am I waiting for?
I don't know.
Me either. Tell who?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Mr.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Miss Bellman.
Yes, Miss Meg.
Brother, there's certainly going to be a lesson to me.
Well, Mr. Bones, how are you this evening?
Me? Oh, boy. I'm the personification of health, Mr. Christie.
Good. Who was that lady?
At the end of the 1980s, television had been in American homes just over 40 years. The status of black Americans had remarkably improved.
You never told us how you feel about black people.
Well, you sure got to hand it to them. I mean, 2 years ago, there was nothing but servants and janitors. Now they're teachers and doctors and lawyers. They've come a long way on TV.
African Americans continue to succeed in prime time. But what of the historic dream that new positive images would help improve America's race relations?
I don't think that you can change 300 years of history, 300 years of exploitation of black people by white people in the West, that you can change hundreds of years of the representation of black people in stereotypical roles just by having a prominent black man in a situation comedy. I mean, it's not going to work that way. Images are one part of a larger formula of social behavior, and you can't give to them all of this importance that they will free us if only we can control them. They do not have enough autonomy to liberate us.
Still, if TV alone cannot liberate us, it continues to mold how we are seen and defined.
One Wiley said we could only sing and dance. Then when we left singing and dancing, we could only be comics. But there is room for the comic, there's room for the dancer, there's room for the singer, there's room for the serious dramatic actor. There is room. What makes you think a whole people have to be alike? And how dull and uninteresting we would be.
What we get is the continuing press towards an American.
Good morning.
Good morning. Those clips represent for me why we're here today. I wanted to start off by thanking Sean Dove, because without Sean's leadership, without his vision, without his thoughts around strategic communications, we wouldn't be here today. A lot of people also often question, you know, why do you bring people together for these type of conversations? What's the impact that you're hoping to do? What's the impact you're hoping to achieve? And I think Sean masterfully said it. He wanted to create the opportunity and space for us as grant makers to first have a conversation about how we best can fund and support nonprofits as well as those creating media, because we know that inside the media rooms there aren't the representation of us inside enough to make the images that we need to see out in the world. But there are individuals inside a newsroom. We have Eric Ekholm today, who is doing the work of trying to tell a nuanced story about the African American experience. But those images that were portrayed, I wanted to highlight. Is Brooklyn in the house? Is there Cats in Brooklyn represent? Is the 20th anniversary of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. The film clip that I showed was from Bamboozled. And if you've watched the film, you understand the damage and impact that 500 years of image making and dehumanization of a people can have. So the fact that we have an African-American president, some may say, was impossible, because if you look at the way that images portray us in the media on a day-to-day basis, you would not think that would be a possibility. But something happened, the glitch in the matrix, and it did become a reality. The context of the second piece or second clip was Esther Rolle speaking about, there's nothing wrong with the diversity of images. There's nothing wrong with comics, performance. But when that's all you see and it's performed within a white supremacist or racist context, it takes us and dehumanizes us in a way that allows for certain policies to exist. So when we look at criminalization of young people, when you criminalize young people and say they're thugs, they're gangsters, they're not worth our commitment in this society, then you have a high arrest rate, you have a high juvenile detention rate. And so this conversation today is really about how do we as philanthropists, how do we as partners with those who are nonprofit seekers, organizers, how do we come together as communication specialists? And I'm very honored to be here with Fenton and OSI partnering around this type of event because of the way that they think about these issues, and the way I think is important for us to think about as philanthropists is we need to work in partnership. That's why we're working with 21st Century Foundation. That's why we're working with Atlantic Philanthropies. That's why we're working with Ford. That's why we're working with all the foundations to try to find partnerships and ways that we can try to address these issues in a direct and a cohesive way. So I just wanted to uplift just a couple of things before. I wanted first, if there are philanthropists in the room, you can stand up. And I know I'm calling you out, but if you can just stand up so we can know who's in the room and who our friends and allies are who are doing this work, we could just give them a round of applause because of the amazing commitment they're having. I also wanted, I know, and Sean already said this, But I wanted to ask if those who are media makers, those who are vision makers, those who have committed their life, like Ron Daniels, to telling stories, Bakari Kidwana, can those individuals stand up so we can see who are in the room, who are media makers, and trying to shift this conversation around, and can we give them a round of applause? I also want to give a shout out to our Baltimore crew. They could see me. I don't think y'all could see them. I want to just uplift Deborah Rubino because they're doing some audacious thinking in Baltimore. And it was during my time at Fenton when I met Deborah. And what I saw happening in the Baltimore office, and Lisa Witter, who's the chairman of the operating officer, of Fenton, and I were in a meeting, and we were just so taken aback with where OSI was taking their thoughts around strategic communications. We were like, this foundation understands the importance of having a clear, articulated vision around communications that's a committed one, not just by uplifting the foundation itself, but uplifting our grantees, uplifting those individuals who need the light, and really trying to tell a more nuanced story. The story that really stuck to me, though, when I spoke with Deborah, was if you live in Harlem, if you live in Baltimore, if you live in BK in Brooklyn, I see young men taking their children to school, but that story is not ever told. I see young men trying to make a difference, but that story's never really being told. And I wonder why, and Deborah was telling me an experience. She was driving to work one day, and she was thinking, why is it? I see these things. I see young men taking their children to school. Why isn't that being told? And I think it's important for us to think about if those things are absent, and you're constantly seeing these constant images of black men committing crimes, black men being arrested, it just imposes a certain idea around you and on you that is hard to break out of. And so when the idea of like we can't break 300 years of oppression, 300 years in this conversation today, what I'm hoping it will do is start a movement, a conversation around how we move forward and ahead. So all that said, I also want to uplift Rakiba Labrie again. She's makes sure that Sean and I are in check, that I don't go over my time too much. But I just want to thank everyone for coming out today, and I want to bring Robert up for us to talk about where we came with this particular piece. The other reason I show those clips is that I don't want the perception to go out that this is somehow a new conversation, that this isn't organic, that this has not become something that didn't start beforehand. There's media makers in the room, there are nonprofits in the room, have been doing this work for a long time. Kari, who's with Brotherhood Sister Soul, they produce media, they do media. Byron, who we're gonna talk about later, who's gonna be on the panel, he produces media. We have Carl Carr, we have Monifa Bandele, we have individuals in the room who are producing and making media. So I just want to say that this conversation wasn't divorced from an understanding that this has been happening and how we can help support it. And that's really where we are today. So this is where this paper came from with Robert. I actually have to uplift him because he was, I would say, a mentor at Fenton Communications, someone I dearly have grown to love. And has enormous understanding of these issues, both as a marginalized person, but also someone who's a strategic thinker around these causes. So I want to bring Robert up to talk a little bit about Fenton, but as well talk about how we came to this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Rashid. Thanks, Sean, and the entire staff at the campaign for Black Male Achievement. Rashid and I worked together for, I think, close to 3 years on a project to challenge negative stereotypes of Muslims in America, also an important project. And we became close and we developed a sense of admiration, mutual admiration and respect for one another. And I actually remember where I was when I got the call from Rashid that he was leaving Fenton. And it was like, ugh, you could, like, right to my heart. I was in an airport hangar in Seattle. He called me on a Sunday. He just, hey, I want to let you know this is what's happening tomorrow. I'm going to let the folks in New York know. And I would, you know, it's one of those situations where when he told me where he was going, it was one of those truly bittersweet moments where you want to kind of bar the door and not let him get out, and at the same time, knowing where he's going and what he's doing, you know that it's the right time and the right moment. I want to, it's an honor to be here. This is such a critical conversation for, it's critical because there is an urgent need. It's critical because it is morally just. And it's critical because we have an opportunity to seize a moment. And I know that, as Rashid pointed out, folks have been working on these issues in the room for a long time. But there is sometimes a tipping point moment that you have to harness. And I think we're at one of those moments. And that's really the heart of the paper that we have put together, which we will be passing out. It's a working draft. We wanted to put it out so that we could share it with you, get your feedback, get your opinions. And in the next several weeks, based on that impact and based on this conversation, take it to the next level and release it into the community of NGOs and philanthropists. So I just want to touch on really three things that we talk about in the paper. So Rashid tells me, I'm leaving, it hurts, and I'm like, what can we do to keep working together? And he's like, well, why don't we try to do something around this effort that I'm going to be working on? So we talked about putting this paper together and hosting an event like this. So this paper makes three very simple but very salient and important points. And the first is that perceptions are powerful. Perceptions are powerful. The spoken word that we heard, CNN, the images that Rashid showed us, they make a difference. They inform how African Americans, including African American young men, think about themselves. They influence how me, as someone who's not African American, thinks about African American young men. And we tell the story in the paper of Claude Steele's research at Stanford. Claude Steele, you may know, is a social psychologist at Stanford. And he, you may be familiar, has done groundbreaking research on what's called stereotype effect. Raise your hand if you've heard of stereotype effect before. Okay? So some folks have heard about it. It's pretty simple. It's research that shows that when you pull together a group of African American students and white students, and you tell them, we're going to give you this GRE test, 20 questions, and we want you to put what your race is. So you mark down, I'm African American or black, or you put down, I'm white or Caucasian. And by the way, this is going to measure how intelligent you are. Guess what happens? The African American students are like, oh, okay. So this is not just me. This is me taking the test for everyone. And what happens when you have that enormous pressure on you? You don't do as well. Did another test. They don't talk about the fact you don't have to mark that you are African American before the test. And they say this is just a prep drill. The achievement gap, the performance gap for the test disappears. So and that's just one example of how perceptions make a difference. Perceptions are powerful. Two, stereotypes are socially created. We saw how they're socially created. They're created through the news. They're created through the stories that we hear, the interactions that we have, the things that we pass down to our children, the jokes, the video games that children play for hours and hours and hours a day. And we tell this story in two different ways. The story of Keith Borders, who is featured in a Washington Post article that some of you may have read a few years ago. He is 6'7", tall, African American. And in sharing his story, he talks about the fact that when I get on an elevator, I don't rush into that elevator. When I hold my posture, I don't stand with my feet apart, I stand with them together. I go out of my way not to scare people. That's something that is learned. And it's learned because he understands in his interactions on a regular basis the body language, the facial expressions, the things that have been said, that he has to act a certain way. So that could be just like, well, you know, there's the whole, maybe you're just reading a little bit too much into it, right? We've heard that before. So, nope, there's a smart test that shows and proves this. So a bunch of smart folks at a couple of universities put together something called the Implicit Automatic Test. Anyone heard of this? The IAT? A few people have heard of it? You could actually go online and just Google IAT and do it, right? So this is the basic gist. It's 5 minutes online, and I first heard about it in reading Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, that came out a few years ago. And Malcolm Gladwell takes the test, and he tells the story. And you go in, and you have a column where when you begin the test, it says African American, and it says European American. And you're shown a series of faces. And one face is Caucasian, and one face is African American. And you have to click as which column they go. Then they start making it a little more confusing, where you have a column that says African American or good, and European American or bad. And then you have to, and then words come up like wonderful, and you have to click which column to put it in. And what it does is it measures down to the millisecond the subconscious reaction that we have to issues around race. And it tells you at the end of the 5 minutes what your automatic preference is. Slight, moderate, strong. For either African Americans or European Americans. Now, here's the interesting point about Malcolm's story. He takes it and he gets a readout that says he has a moderate preference for European Americans. Malcolm Gladwell, if you don't know him, is mixed race, son of a Jamaican mother and a white father. And he's like, oh my God, am I a racist, self-hating black man? So he's, you know, kind of freaking out, right? You know, you're like, oh my God, I just discovered, took a 5-minute test, and I'm all of a sudden I'm racist. And he takes it again, and then again, and then again, and he gets the same outcome each time. And then he goes and talks to the people who run it and finds out that 50% of African Americans, 80% of all people who take it show that they have a bias towards European Americans. 50% of African Americans who take it show that they have a bias towards a preference towards European Americans. These things are learned through the images, the stories that we come into contact with on a daily basis. The final thing that we talk about in the paper is that it is possible to unmake the stereotypes that have been socially created. I agree with the comment that one sitcom might not make a difference, but collectively unleashing an avalanche of powerful stories and role models can make a difference. And we tell this by telling the story of, that's going back to where we started, stereotype effect. So Claude Steele does this great research, and then a new set of researchers come along, and they're like, well, what happens if there's something that challenges the stereotype? So in 2008, they, over the course of four periods, they had, again, a group of black students and white students take 20 GRE questions. And they did the same thing, tell us your race, and by the way, this is going to tell us how smart you are. And they discovered on two occasions that there was the same performance gap that you see when you prime people's brains with the, this is you representing all African Americans. And then 2 times of performance gap mysteriously disappeared. People know why? Any ideas or theories as to why the performance gap disappeared on those 2 occasions? On one occasion, the test was given right after Barack Obama accepted the Democratic nomination to become president, the first African-American to do so. The second time, after he got elected. Broke the stereotype. The stereotype threat disappeared. And the performance gap disappeared. So it is possible to unmake stereotypes. And that's why we're here. We're here because we want to have a conversation about how we can harness communications, how we can change the stories that are being told and the images and the words that are being used to dramatically transform people's perceptions of African Americans and especially of African American young men. Not just for America and for those of us who are not African American, but also for young African American men too. So thank you again for the opportunity to share, and we'll be passing out the paper. And we really do, it is a working draft. We wanted to get it out to you so that you had something to wrap your head around, but we invite your observations, your thoughts, your ideas of ways that we can take it to the next level. And we hope to be sharing a final draft in the next 2 to 4 weeks. Thanks.
So knowing Sean, he's probably like, we were off schedule. So we're trying to try to get back on schedule. So I just want to do one other thing, is that if it didn't come through those images, is that a conversation of African-American male imagery is not divorced from the conversation of African-American women imagery, is not divorced of how masculinity plays into these issues. The story of black men has to be tied to a story of black women, black community, black children. You can't change one image without changing the other image. And if you didn't see that in the presentation that was before us with what Deja was speaking of, then I hope before the end of today that we understand that the images of black males is also correspondent to those of African American women, also all marginalized individuals. So before I introduce our moderator, I know everyone's ready for the panel, I want to just read quickly a piece from Lynetta Gilbert from the Ford Foundation, where she was quoted in Wit and Wisdom, a publication that was put out. And she says that, I hold a deep conviction that philanthropy has a critical role to play in enriching the imagination of the public about what is possible in the places where they live. I really do believe, because I've seen it happen many times over the past 20 years, that philanthropy can help people imagine and work toward realizing a new future. What happens too often is that people become isolated from one another and from new ideas. Part of what I've tried to do through my investments has been to create space and opportunity for people across all spectrums of a community to engage in thoughtful conversations about how they want their community to be different, and to provide resources for people to dream, experiment, struggle, and discover for themselves the possibility of working differently and being different in relationships with one another. I think that's what this conversation is about today, for us to be with one another, to begin a conversation anew, and hopefully move forward. So with that, I'd like to bring on our moderator, Curtis Stephen. What I'm going to do before he comes up, I'm going to introduce him, but before he comes up, there's some clips of some of the work that the panelists themselves has produced. For those who don't know Curtis, I've also grown to really enjoy our interaction. He's a writer, columnist, and most importantly, he's a former OSI media fellow. So all that to say, and not to get too deep into it, but Curtis Stephen, we're very happy to have him today to moderate this conversation. And with that said, I'm going to go into the clips of the panelists themselves, and then we'll have them come up and begin the conversation. Thank you.
black manhood to the degree that it made middle-class men lose their place in the eyes of women. Not in a real sense, but in terms of the media image. If it wasn't thugged out, then it wasn't manhood.
As men, many times we have a hard time learning how to love something. To love something. To love something. To love something.
That's why we always emphasize telling our kids that we love them, showing them that we love them.
Daddy be Captain Daddy and save the world.
Black men, a lot of times, they're raised by their mothers and aunties and their grandmas, and they're coddled. And they do everything for them. They can get away with whatever they want to. And then they grow up just waiting for these women to take care of them. Stand up and be a man and walk, you know, on your own. No one's going to hold your hand.
Are you chicken? Are you chicken?
Pretty well. I did, I got mainly A's and B's.
I'm an AB student. Occasional, you know, I try not to get too many C's. If a C was in there, I made sure I picked it up.
I was a pretty good student. I was very good in elementary, junior high, and pretty good in high school. College, I dropped out after 2 years, but I was decent.
What advice do you have for African-American boys in their education?
I definitely say, you know, the street smarts and the book smarts, you put those two together, you can accomplish anything. Always stay in school. Education is first and foremost.
The more you educate yourself and you learn at a young age to be educated, that's take more value to your life, and hopefully you can make it out the ghetto.
You know, my advice to black youth, black boys in particular, is to first and foremost realize who you are, that you come from a legacy of greatness that is so profound.
Man, get your education while you're in school. Nobody want to finish it while you're in school, but when you get out, like just like your mom and dad are telling you, you're going to appreciate school when you get out.
You know, it's the ultimate weapon, because once you have an education, once you develop a knowledge base, you have ultimate control over your destiny.
As long as you tell yourself you can do it and you believe you can do it and you always see where you want to go and you're going to make up your mind to get there, make the right decision, trust me, you can do it.
And I think that African-American men got to decide young that the whole world thinks they won't be a convict and go to jail, a drug dealer, a hoodlum, or a thug. You got to say, I ain't got to be what they say. I'm going to make an image in my own mind and be what I want to be.
Say it loud.
Say it loud! Say it loud.
How y'all doing? I'm Master P. Say it loud.
Say it loud.
Say it loud. Say it loud, y'all. Say it loud, y'all. Go ahead and do it.
In our community, in the black community, masculinity is associated with how many women you have, how many kids you have, how many times you've been in and out of prison.
You could not look at him and say that being intelligent was a contradiction to being black and male.
There is a bit of 50 and a Barack in every black man.
50 Cent had no chance of winning in the realm of hip-hop.
Hip-hop, movies, all sorts of other things have been active in the process of making that image the dominant image of black men in the United States.
Barack equaled Harvard. Someone like 50 Cent equaled Hood. Hood equaled virility. Harvard equaled impotence. And it made me think about the way manhood had evolved in terms of blackness over a period of time and how dangerous it had become. Gangster rap had begun to shape the definition of black manhood to the degree that it made, certainly I think, middle class men lose their place in manhood in the eyes of women. Not in a real sense, but in terms of the media image. Because everywhere you went, the image of manhood in every form of creative media came out of that 50 Cent mold. If it wasn't thugged out, then it wasn't manhood. And for too many of young boys, both here in the US and certainly in London, there aren't those male figures, so then all they have to define manhood is what comes out of the small screen or what comes out of a magazine or what comes out of a hip-hop video. The beauty of the presence and the emergence of Barack Obama isn't Barack Obama, it's Michelle Obama. Because in Michelle, for black women, there was an affirmation of their strength could still find them a great guy.
We as white
managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com. Thank you for visiting our site. We are pleased and excited to bring you the first of our BBN original video series. In my travels throughout the city of New York, I began to notice the abundance of provocative images of black and Latino women displayed on newsstands. As a black and Latino woman, I am concerned about how our images are treated, so much so that I chose this story to be the launch story of our BBN video series. We are member supported. Become a BBN member by registering at blackandbrownnews.com. And if you want to see more reports like this, your donations will help us do so. Gracias.
Each year, millions of commuters and tourists alike pass through New York City's vast subway system and streets. One of the most prevalent businesses catering to tourists and locals alike are newsstands, selling newspapers and magazines of every kind, type, and in various languages. But through their businesses, some are selling a distorted view of black and Latino women.
We're talking about newsstands, the way that the vendors specifically arrange things as where black and Latino women are up front, and because you can't miss it. Like, I'm going to buy a newspaper, and right there I got some brown titties in my face. You know what I'm saying?
On many...
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to this really town hall meeting, this family gathering. It's an honor for me to be back here. As Rashid mentioned, I am a former fellow here, and once a fellow, always a fellow. I'm going to invite the panelists to come up as I talk, and definitely going to introduce everybody here. We're obviously going to talk about some of the video clips that you just saw and give you a good sense of what this is all about and why this is such a critical topic. Obviously, all of you have come out here today, and I think that speaks to the topic of why this is so important. Everybody from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King, Langston Hughes to Oscar Micheaux have been steeped in this very important, critical issue for decades now. And I guess it might have been said initially at the beginning, but of course all of you folks have gone to many a panel through the years, so you all know that you can check your cell phones and make sure that it's on vibrate. There's nothing like hosting one of these sessions and hearing a ringtone of your favorite song, and you go, "What? Is that off the wall or something?" And you know, you may not want to see me dance today, so that might not be the appropriate time. But let us begin this critical session. I get to speak to Jordan Coleman, who is to my immediate right, and if you can tell by just looking at him, you can see he's a very young man. Believe it or not, he's only 13 years old. 13. I think I told him earlier that when I was 13, I was only dreaming. He's 13, and he's actually doing. So that is Jordan Coleman, who is here with us. You see to his right, we have, well, man needs no introduction, but he'll still get it. Byron Hurt, who is an award-winning filmmaker, and of course was responsible for Barak and Curtis, which we saw there as well. Also, we have Rashad Robinson, who's here with us from GLAAD. He's a longtime activist as well. Also to his right, Eric Eckholm of the New York Times, veteran correspondent. And to his right, that is Loren Harris over there, who of Thinking Man Public, Thinking Man Public Media? Is that the consulting? All right, that's the formal title. And longtime activist as well, longtime voice in the community, who very much knows about these issues of philanthropy, issues of images, very much responsible too for the Black Masculinity Project, which we'll talk to him about as well. And to his right, finally, Sharon Toomer, who is the founder and editor of blackandbrownnews.com. I'll say it again, blackandbrownnews.com. Definitely check it out. Just want to begin here first with really a specific question for everybody, and we'll go down the line and talk to them about really their work and how it matches up to this broader issue of imagery and how their work fits into how Black men are seen and perceived. And let me also say at the outset as well that a great number of our panelists here are also consistently involved with images that, as it relates to gender and women of color as well. So they also have a strong track record and could be equally versed on that topic as well. Jordan, good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm terrific. We just watched Say It Loud film, which we can see at sayitloudfilm.com, the trailer for it. Talk about really the incentive there to go and produce this, because I think for a lot of us who were watching it, we saw Kobe Bryant, we saw Ludacris, and one of the things we would often say, it's pretty ludicrous that we don't see those actors, artists, and entertainers talking about education much. They often talk about what's their latest sneaker or their latest cologne. Talk about putting that together and why.
Well, it all started because I'm the voice of a cartoon character, Tyrone the Moose, on the Backyardigans. And my mom challenged me to do something with the money that I made from Backyardigans to make a positive contribution to my community. Because the first thing I was thinking about was buying some sneakers and clothes, you know. Of course. But after we decided that I wanted to make a film, she said, what's the film going to be about? And I saw in school how African-American boys weren't really focusing on their schoolwork. They were focusing on being the next Kobe Bryant or Lil Wayne or next NFL superstar. So I got all their favorite celebrities and put them in a film and named it Say It Loud. And the reason why I put all their favorite celebrities is that you just don't want to hear from anybody. You want to hear from the people who you look up to. Like, you listen to your mom because you respect your mom, you love your mom, and you want... She has the best for you, and you believe that your favorite idols have the same thing for you. So I believe that if you have your favorite idols and your favorite heroes in a film, then you'll listen to it.
Thank you. Byron Hurt as well, also here with us. You folks know him because millions of people watched Independent Lens a few years ago and saw Beyond Beats and Rhymes, but he also produced Barak and Curtis, which we saw here today. Byron, we spoke about this before. Some folks may have the crisis issue where we talked about you putting that film together. And talk about those two individuals as far as going in and comparing and contrasting two people that no one would ever think of comparing and contrasting ever, which is Barak and Curtis. How did that come about?
I have no idea. Barak and Curtis was a really crazy idea that I had, that I came up with one evening after I heard about the Masculinity Project. And they were looking for projects that would become viral on the internet. And I started to think about what would catch people's eye, what would people be interested in seeing. And at that particular time, Barack Obama was emerging as the Democratic front runner for the Democratic Party. And it was just really interesting to me to kind of look at Barack Obama, who was like this person who was emerging, and his style of masculinity, the way he presented himself, which is so different from many of the images that we've seen in popular culture around black men and black masculinity, that I thought it would make a really interesting comparison and a contrast. So what I tried to do in the film was to present these two very different kind of black men, African-American men, who have completely different styles of masculinity, and to present it in a way that was going to make young people and just people in general think about the representations of black masculinity and the different ways that you can attain power, money, influence, success, and that sort of thing. Because one of the things, I do a lot of work in high schools and middle schools, colleges, et cetera. And whenever I talk to young people, especially young black men, and I ask them, you know, what they want to be, what they want to do in life, and, you know, a lot of people in this room are probably very familiar with this kind of thing. A lot of young men, when you ask them what they want to do or who they want to be in life, they want to be a rapper, they want to be an entertainer or an athlete. And so I just thought that it would be really good to present these two different people and to get young men to think outside of the box in terms of what they can be, right? To think about all of the range of masculinity that exists beside just what we see in popular culture on a day-to-day. So that's how Barack and Curtis came together. And it's a 10-minute short, and in my opinion, that the subject can be more fully explored because I think it's very deep, and I think that there's a lot of nuances, not just to figures like 50 Cent, but also to Barack Obama, whose own masculinity is definitely something that has been questioned, under attack from a lot of different angles. And I think that his own story of masculinity has yet to be played out as he is, leading the country. So that's what Barack and Curtis was about, and that's how I arrived at the idea.
No doubt. Thank you for that. We'll talk a bit more with him about some of these broader issues as well. Rashad of the Gay, and I'll make sure I get the acronym correct, because we know GLAAD. We've known GLAAD for many, many, many a year now for all the work that it does on behalf of men who are gay, and of course the official title, Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Of course, those of us who are in the media know GLAAD, and we just say GLAAD all the time. So talk a bit about how your work relates specifically to black men.
Well, thank you all for having us here and doing this panel. I think it's incredibly important. I've been at GLAAD for about 4 years now, and I'm the senior director of programs, so I oversee GLAAD's programmatic work within the organization and a lot of our advocacy work with media around promoting, you know, fair, accurate, inclusive images of the gay community as a whole. And so that includes, dealing specifically with African-American men. And as the lead African-American man within the organization, I have a particular interest in how my community is represented and how, you know, young boys and young girls grow up thinking about, you know, what it means to be gay, what it means to be lesbian, what it means to think about your sexuality, and how the media puts our community in all sorts of different boxes. And so, just to put this kind of in a lens of why this is important to me, I'm going to talk a little bit about Carl Joseph Walker Hoover. And he is a young boy, was a young boy, who committed suicide recently in Massachusetts because he was taunted and bullied because the worst thing to be called in the playground is gay, or some sort of kind of worse, you know, word connected to gay. And all across our playgrounds and our schoolyards, outside of the kind of political issues that we see debated in Capitol Hills, you know, across states, these issues are playing out for young people. And they're playing out in ways, whether young people know what their sexuality is or not, they're playing out in ways of, you know, how they think about themselves and how they think about each other. And the media plays an incredible role in how people get their information. It sends us cultural cues about who we are and what we think about the world. And for me, when I see the just incredible invisibility of African-American gay men in mainstream media, and when I do see it, it's either kind of as predators who are putting straight women in harm, or as men who have either made some sort of mistake or have left their community or their church because they are kind of not part of the larger black framework. I do think that this is part of the reframing that has to take place within, you know, our community. If we're going to be a whole family, if we're going to think about truly rebuilding our communities and really think about how do black men fit into it, it has to be about all of us. And so I'd love to be able to talk about that and talk about the Carl Joseph Walkers because, you know, we just came off an election of Yes We Can. And for young, you know, gay children and young gay boys who are growing up, they need to live in a Yes We Can world as well.
Thank you for that. Eric Ekholm, veteran New York Times correspondent, I believe 24 years, correct? You, of course, travel across the country, and he was also the former Beijing bureau chief as well for the New York Times. Those of you who are following the situation right now in Western China, Eric Ekholm, very much a verse on those issues and could very well hold a symposium on that as well. But he's here to talk about media as it relates to black males because of his reporting. And it's interesting, if you were to do a search of your name, even before I finished typing it, that story comes up. Studies, the framing of it, the term, quite deep into for black men studies show, and that's right next to your name. Talk about the level of reporting that you do about black males specifically, which you go through your 24-year career, and there's a fair number of reporting about it. Is that based on personal interest or just the assigning of all these stories to you?
Well, in 24 years, I think I've had about four or five stories assigned to me that were worth anything. It's really up to reporters to come up with the ideas, you see. I see one of the great pioneers of African-American female reporting, Sheila Rule, is here, who was with the Times forever. And she knows, if we get later into some of the problems and dilemmas of reporting on these issues, she knows far better than I do. But first, let me say I'm grateful to be here, but when I saw the invitation, I stopped for a minute. I wasn't sure if I was the good guy or the bad guy. I've always been interested in social issues, but you have, as a reporter, both for your politically within the organization, but also for the quality of your work, you have to be very careful not to get carried away with any cause. And there's a great danger if you get typecast as a sort of bleeding heart propagandist for this or that. Your stature will go down, and your stories won't be as good. And I've tried really to pursue the truth, and sometimes that means not sugarcoating stories. And that the story that you've all mentioned that helped lead to this was one of the very first I did when I got appointed to a national poverty beat that had been dormant for a couple of years, shamefully. I think the paper, like others, was a bit embarrassed after Hurricane Katrina that they hadn't been. There were periods certainly when we did a lot about urban issues and race issues and poverty, but it had kind of fallen off the radar. And I went around talking to people, what's going on, and this was after the period of welfare reform when all the attention was on young black women having babies and are they going to work or not and do we have to force them to work or not, and to put it in the most negative way. And I was particularly struck, Dr. Ron Minsey at Columbia, who 15 years earlier I had edited a series about the welfare system and wrote part of that and had quoted him saying, you know, we're ignoring the men here. And if you want someone to support children and you want to have families, then somebody better start paying attention to what's happening to young African-American men. So 15 or 20 years later, I talked to him and he was saying the same thing, only now all of the statistics were 10 times worse. And between his work and a remarkable sociologist named Bruce Western, who's now at Harvard, then was at Princeton, who found new ways to look at statistics to show the true extent of unemployment and incarceration and other problems among different groups, I felt, well, sure, at one level, we all know there are lots of problems and poverty in the black community, but the numbers were just so startling that I felt if I'm surprised by this as a fairly literate, concerned person, most people have no idea. So I reported the numbers, but then I also, and I'm grateful that some have mentioned that I seem to write with some sympathy or understanding, I went and looked up some of the subjects of these numbers. I went to Baltimore and hung out for a few days with the help of the great Joe Jones, who I know many of you know, and let some young men tell their stories. And so I wasn't saying they were good or bad, but this is how they got to where they are, and put that out. And the reaction was quite astonishing. It's the biggest I've ever had in 24 years to a story. We have a very nice thing now where readers can click on your name and send an email. I must have had 300 emails in 2 days. And I was quite worried there would be a lot of vilification and anger, but 90% were very appreciative, including mothers, preachers, men running from prison, saying, thanks for drawing attention to this. We got to do something. I did get, you know, a few from white racists saying, see, that they're getting what they deserve. And I did get a few from angry African Americans saying, you're just stereotyping us again. And even a few African American colleagues in the media reacted that way. And I happen to know that at the Washington Post, the next day there was a discussion, both saying, what can we do? But also, this was too negative. And that led to a series about black men and the very story that someone mentioned of the tall man scaring people was a product of that. So if I can take credit for triggering that, I can live with that. Anyway, there's lots more to talk about.
Yeah, indeed. Lauren Harris, there's lots to talk to you about as well. Let me just, because folks saw the video there, and obviously some may have the issue of the crisis, talk to you about the Black Masculinity Project, because you did conceive it. It is your baby. You are the founder. Talk about how you decided to actually do that. I know it's a long journey in having produced it and a lot of folks that became involved with it, but what was the driving incentive for creating it?
I think in a word or in two words, mental hygiene. I mean, I think that one of the things I was struck as Rashid showed the videos at the start of our morning, sort of the old movie footage, Birth of a Nation and other stuff, bamboozled footage, is just how mentally unhealthy America is and how sick, really, it is to have those kinds of images perpetrated among on a group of people around the and then pervade around the world as truth, and I think, you know, we're sort of at a critical moment now. We have an opportunity and opening, and we get these every so often to try to battle back. The Matrix reference I thought was a nice one, Rashid, to try to really reauthor the narrative in a way that's healthier for the nation. And I think the crime really against humanity that's been committed here by America is its perpetration of outright lies about black people and about black men, in particular today's topic. And so the purpose of the Black Masculinity Project was really to try to fight the matrix, was really try to counter a set of negative narrations about black people, about black men, about black masculinity, the ways in which black masculinity has been narrowly framed. This is a way to really try to heal the sort of social, mental, spiritual health of black men, to give voice and a space for black people, black women and black men, black youth in particular, to articulate a new, healthier way of conceiving of black masculinity. And it was a space for incubation, of incubating ideas and conceptions of masculinity that could become viral, as Byron said. And you know, Barack and Curtis was a perfect example of what we hoped the site would do. And when we conceived of it, myself and my colleague who isn't here today, unfortunately, Orlando Bagwell from the Ford Foundation, when I was at Ford, the notion was that we would create a space online, a medium through which young people could tell their own stories, could create media and upload it, or could access media that was on that site and create a viral community around it, blogging around it, or whatever they wanted to do with it to make the conversation more widespread. And since we couldn't find good strategies at that time for engaging the mainstream media, we thought the next best effort was for people to create their own media and to go around above or under the mainstream media, whatever the case may be, to get more effective stories that were out there that were healthier for the mental well-being of black people, but indeed the nation.
Sharon Toomer, you're the Director of Communications and Membership for the Association of Black Foundation Executives, and obviously founder and managing editor of blackandbrownnews.com. We watched the video footage there of you heading out to the newsstand, and it's interesting. Of course, you've concentrated on the images of women and the misogyny and secularization that goes along with that, but you very well could have done a similar video, right, on the images as it relates to black men. I wear glasses, so I can't pull off the intimidation look, but if you look at some of those covers there, we know the sort of ice grill stare and the sort of postures that, of course, Byron has covered for so long as well, and hip-hop imagery. But what led you down to the path of going down to the streets of Manhattan with a camera and talking to newsstands vendors who didn't particularly seem happy to see you there?
No, they weren't happy to see us there. And I didn't grow up in New York. I was born in New York but didn't grow up in New York. And so if you don't ride the subways daily for all of your life, and these images, they just become part of your daily, you just don't pay attention to it, it's just there. But I moved here in 99, and these images were increasingly offensive in how they're displayed. So what started off is, okay, that's, that wouldn't happen. I moved here from Atlanta, went to school there, grew up in D.C., and we never saw any of those images in newsstands. Very car-driven city. So here it's a commuting city. And but it just seemed to get more and more offensive. And these images were just front and center. So at first I was going to do a print piece, but as we know, visual is just far more impacting. And, it's not just, it's not about censorship, and I need to make that clear, nor is it just a gender one gender issue. It is a community issue. And these are the images, and if you notice, there are black men on those magazine covers. They're not, some of them are single gender, and they just have one woman on, and they just have a woman on there, but a lot of them are the celebration of these images, and it includes black men. What I was most offended by, because I'm not, obviously, I would sound very silly talking about any form of censorship as the founder and managing editor of a news and information publication. So this is not about censorship. To each his own, and far be it from us to get in the way of people's reading habits and likes. What this is more about is that it's the protection of some women and the exploitation of others. So if you look and notice, there's this... And this particular on newsstands, who are owned and managed by people of color, they go to great lengths to cover the images, the like images of white women, but they go above and beyond to put the images of black and Latino women. And I'm not talking necessarily about white Latino women, but Latino women of color. We all come, we come in many shades, and put them front and center. What I found interesting is that in the research for this, is that there are laws that actually protect, that make it prohibitive. You're not allowed to do that. And in some instances, some of these newsstands could possibly be violating the law. They're not pornographic magazines, so it's not like they have, they're not Bootylicious and Playboy that have to be put in the back, but I was more offended. I was on a couple of radio shows behind this, and just this this lack of urgency or outrage that a community would allow their women and their men to be exploited in this way by anybody else. I just don't know any other community that would permit this. So, and it's low hanging fruit because there are laws that say you can't do this. So that was the inspiration for that, and that's really what Black and Brown News is about. I can tell you this. I've worked in mainstream newsrooms, and me going to pitch that story to one of my editors would have fallen flat. So that is why a Black and Brown News exists, to bring those stories to light. And also, there's been some change behind it. The video now sits with the Commissioner of Human Rights, although their office doesn't go after this. It just shows you the reach that this has had.
Thank you, Sharon. Time flies when you're having fun, and of course I have maybe about 150,000 questions. because we have a dynamic panel. And of course, if you see me looking over, it's because we have so many people here, which is great, and so many people who have information to share. Of course, all of you, so many of you here are very much dynamic individuals yourselves. I think Sean said any number of you could be up here as well. Looking out into the audience, we see folks like Ron Daniels, who very much was a part of Jesse Jackson's campaign back in the day. We see veteran journalists like Caddy Gray and Sheila Rule. So there's a great wealth of folks who have their own perspective and information. So, you know, I just have a few questions here, and all this to say it's a dialogue, and we want to very much have you as a part of the conversation. I didn't plan to begin this way, but Jordan, I'll start with you. Just for some quick perspective, you know, for all of us who are maybe a little bit older than you, we might have seen some of those images. I met your mom, so I imagine you are very much steeped in history and culture. But just to get a sense of what you felt when you saw some of those images of us, people of color, black males specifically, from the 1930s, 40s, and after that, what did you think?
Well, I think it's almost just like how nowadays. I mean, people, African-American males, on TV, they're either angry, they look like fools, or they're the comedians. From back in the 1920s to Amos and Andy, which was just horrible. I saw that show for the first time on YouTube, and I was shocked. To Tracy Morgan on 30 Rock, they all want to be funny, and it's not all about being funny. It's either you're funny or you're a gangster. I mean, there's a show now on MTV called G's to Gents, where there's all gangsters trying to fix their life around. I mean, a lot of them are improving, but still, you don't have to be gangster in order to have people liking you. I mean, you could be clean cut without flossing. It's just ridiculous how people don't look at life in a nice, clean way. They think that they have to get where they want to get no matter what, and that's not true.
Let me just show you all a book here. This is a vintage copy of Gil Noble's Black is the Color of My TV Tube. Many of you folks, of course, here in the New York area know Gil Noble, veteran reporter. I may have borrowed or stolen this book from my brother. Depends on how you look at these things. But he did autograph it for my brother back in 1981, when it first came out. Eric Eckholm, let me get to you here. I just want to read a quote that Gil Noble, even though it's, you know, 25 years old or so.
I
imagine he would say that if he wrote a book today, he would pretty much say the same thing, and some of those thoughts echoed this morning. It says, certain dimensions of the black community, such as its positive values and achievements, seldom get aired. He goes on to say, many say that the mass media don't want to show anything positive about blacks, because that would compromise the self-esteem of many whites who base their sense of superior importance on the subjugation of other people. You know, obviously, when you go into these stories and you go in and you have to report, and there's so much going on, you know, give people a sense of what that process is like, because often when somebody reads a story, they deconstruct it. Who was quoted? What race, what perspective they're coming from. How much planning do you do when you go into a story as far as who gets quoted, you know, what are the different elements that you put into a story?
Well, there's a certain amount of just serendipity to the whole process, I think, but to start with, you've got to sell a story as something that's newsworthy or a striking new phenomenon or something that isn't obvious or well known to everyone. And it isn't just for African Americans. We don't write about good news very often, because the happy family living in the suburbs doing okay is not news. When suddenly the father is losing his job of 30 years, as is happening recently, then that family becomes news, black or white. You know, earlier someone said, why don't we ever write about, you know, the father walking his child to school? Well, I can imagine a context in which we could do that, but if and I'm making up numbers here, but if 70% of the children in that neighborhood have no fathers around, and their families are in deep poverty and trouble as a result. Which is the more important news? I can understand why, you'd like to see that positive image over and over to sort of help train kids to think differently. But the crisis is the 70% of missing fathers. And so the media tends to gravitate toward negative news. And you also can't manage it. I had a story just in the paper last week. There's a bunch of very interesting, depressing research on what we already instinctively know, but very rigorous social science research on what it does to a child to have a parent going to prison. Both the obvious economic effects, but the psychological effects, and even take into account the difficult neighborhoods, poverty, other environmental factors, just the fact of seeing your father go to prison, spend time in prison, leads children to be more likely to be violent themselves, more likely to drop out of school, girls more likely to be pregnant, and there's some very striking research. Okay, well, I started with that again. It's sort of similar to that story 3 years ago. And then I went to Baltimore and Washington and talked to some young people who've had parents incarcerated, and a man, a great man, seems to me, who spent 13 years, got out in prison and got out recently and is trying to rebuild his family, kind of a heroic story. And we did a whole video, a audio slideshow, much more than was in the newspaper about him. And I think it's a very inspiring story. But I started out thinking I'm gonna have a very positive example too. I met a 20-year-old kid in Washington who was out on probation with an ankle bracelet, awaiting sentencing, but he was given a second chance. He was in a Strive Jobs program. He seemed very determined. His girlfriend is pregnant. He's going to turn his life around. He'd never been a serious drug addict or anything, but he'd been on the streets mostly for many years and had an armed robbery and drug charge. But he was turning things around. He says, I'm not going to let this happen to my child. I'm going to be there for him. So I thought, great, I've got the lead for my story and the ending, too. And unfortunately, about a week after I interviewed him, he absconded. He just sort of freaked out and went back to the streets. And now he's probably this week he'll get sentenced for at least 3 years. And so my story had a sad ending. And I'm not going to sugarcoat that either, because that shows, I can't imagine the psychological forces and fears in his head that he couldn't deal with the prospect of making it, but it's sad.
Yeah, let me get reaction to Byron here, but first let me go to you, Lauren, because I know time is even shorter for you here. And this is something we've talked about before as far as what the images are, particularly in the mainstream press, what is being shown and what isn't being shown. As somebody who's really not in the newsroom, but obviously reads the newspapers, what aren't you seeing? Why do you think you're not seeing it? Here you have a reporter sitting right next to you who talks about fighting to get these stories in, and we talked about some of the nuances of...
Yeah. And I did a profile of Mr. Hurt because Lauren introduced me to him.
well, that says something and may be helpful for folks who are out there and wondering, how do you get a story into the New York Times?
You meet with Eric Eckholm and buy him a nice lunch. That's how you do it. I think this is an important question. Part of what we don't see in the mainstream media is, I should say, just to give a nod to our friends in alternative media, is picked up in alternative media. And one of the things we could do is actually be more supportive of people of color media, and media owned by people of color. Our local independent black-owned and Latino-owned and Asian-American-owned newspapers could use a few more pennies, particularly in a period like this. So I'll put that out there. I think that's one part of it, is actually give more more credence to the work that, journalists of color are doing at independent outlets. But I think in terms of mainstream press, one of the things I think is missing, and it's not necessarily even good stories or stories about good people. It's actually stories about conflict sometimes. It's actually stories about race that are more nuanced. It's actually stories that take account of race and gender, where those dynamics exist. And when we're talking about black men, they exist. I said this to Curtis, I like to talk about the Gina Six narrative because I actually spoke with U.S. Attorney General Donald Washington in the aftermath of Gina Six, and he was the U.S. Attorney General who was responsible for overseeing the actions of the local district attorney in that case. And Donald Washington had been quoted as saying that in his review of all of the affidavits that were taken locally, he didn't see any evidence that this was a conflict between black and white boys that was rooted in race. He said rather he thought it was about male bravado. And so I thought that was a curious statement and hadn't really, at that time, when I spoke with Donald Washington, received much coverage. It had run in a paper in Virginia and the AP had picked it up, but it hadn't really been reproduced in a number of papers around the country. It has since then. And so I called Donald Washington and he said, yeah, I read the affidavits. Everyone I talked with said these boys, the incident with the noose occurred in the beginning of the school year. These young men played a full season of football together, black and white guys blocking for each other, running with each other. And then the incident with the fight occurred much later in the academic year. And when you look at the testimonies that local people gave, it didn't seem that they were fighting about race, but rather chest thumping around slurs that were degrading to one another and around their bravado, around their masculinity. And given the work that I was doing at that time at the Ford Foundation, I thought that that was actually newsworthy. I thought that the uproar that we were making around race could have been nuanced nicely, not to discard race, but nuanced nicely by including a lens on this topic. It was a hot story at the time that looked at the role that gender played. It looked at the role that young men, the ways in which young men use gender-based slurs to degrade one another and to dehumanize one another. We missed that opportunity with Gina Six, and I think we've missed it several occasions since then. You look at stories, for example, with Sean Bell, the horrific murder of a young African-American man here in New York City who was out on an evening to celebrate his last night as a single man before he was married the next day. He was murdered. Many of you know that story. Some of the coverage about the Sean Bell case actually talks about what happened inside the club that night, and one of the things that's come out in more recent period is there was chest thumping apparently between Sean Bell's crew, or reportedly, I should say, between Sean Bell's friends and guys and the police officers inside the club. There was some male bravado conflict, the way in which it has been characterized in the newspaper. Now, there's no more explanation than male bravado in the story, right? So you could take that to mean many, many things. Many of us who are men in the room and some of our women in the room will know exactly what that means. My point is, in the stories, there often is an altogether omission of the role that gender is playing in the conflicts that we see in our communities and the conflicts we see in society. And I think in both cases of Sean Bell case and the Gina Six, we missed opportunities to really cover those stories in a much more nuanced way that brought out the role that gender was playing in the way in which Byron and others in this room have written about it. And so I think that those kinds of more nuanced treatments of really critical news stories could really play up the way in which we think about race and gender and young men of color.
Byron, you were just cited there. You were sitting listening to this. I sense you had some reaction.
Yeah, I've just been patiently waiting, because I have a lot to say about this. I just think we have to, as media makers, and there are a whole lot of media makers in this room that I know, that I see, I'm looking at them right now, we have to create our own stories. We have to use whatever platforms that we have at our disposal right now to get our stories out and our stories heard, and we have to do it well, and we have to do it with care. And we have to raise our own standards in terms of what it is that we produce, what it is that we put out to the world, and to tell our own stories. And I think that's just the bottom line. I mean, I just think that, corporate media is not going to tell nuanced stories, complicated stories about people of color, poor people. That's not their role. Their role is to reinforce the status quo, to reinforce white supremacy, to reinforce negative ideas and attitudes about brown people, in my opinion, and women and gay people and whoever is not white and male and straight. That's my opinion. So I think that there's no better time than now than to use new media to tell your own stories. I mean, I'm on Facebook all of the time. I see and I watch those little 5-minute clips that random people put up on their Facebook pages. I click on them and I watch them because they're interesting to me, you know. And I think that now is a time where people have so much more access to media than we've ever had before. I went to an electronics store and I bought an HD camera that cost $149, right? And it's a good camera, and you know, it's not a broadcast quality camera, but it's a good quality camera that people can use to tell their own stories and upload it onto Facebook and have more control over who we are presenting of ourselves to the world. You know, so we don't have to sit back and we have to wait and we have to like protest and rally and do all these different things to get mainstream media to present nuanced images of who we are. Yes, that's important. I think that we have to do that. We have to continue to do that. But I think we also have to take the bull by the horns and we have to create the kind of media that we want to see of ourselves. That's why I take my responsibility, I take my role as a media maker very, very seriously. I see it as a responsibility, and I want people to feel that whenever I create something, whatever the story is, whether it's about masculinity, whether it's about, whatever, culture, race, class, culture, whatever the story is that I'm creating, I want people to know that I'm putting into it as much care and concern and honesty and respect and intelligence. And not just that, but also having a standard of excellence where people can feel good about the product that they're receiving from me. And I think that that's, you know, more of us have to do that. You know, we have to raise the bar. We have to push each other. And I think we also need to be supported, continue to be supported by a lot of these philanthropic institutions who don't necessarily support us. Lauren, you know, you have been a champion for many people. You know, the Masculinity Project was a great project that you supported. But I'm one of many media makers out here of color who are dying for support, who want money, who want resources, you know. And we're all competing for the very small, very narrow, limited pool of funds, right? So, you know, we have to be supported because I think that we are the ones who are going to bring those very fresh, intelligent, nuanced stories to the public, whether it's social media sites, whether it's PBS or what other institutions that are willing to support us. But we are the only ones that are going to be able to deliver that kind of content and media with the kind of care that only we can, right? Because people who are outside of our community, they're not going to be able to deliver the product with the same level of care and insightfulness that we can. So that's what I've been dying to say this whole time. Mm.
Let me, and I'm going to take you, Sharon, and Rashad in just a moment, but as we're coming up on the 11 o'clock hour, because there's so many folks in the room, obviously we're going to go a little bit over, but just by a show of hands, who here already has a question? Just by a show of hands. Wow. Okay. So here's what we're obviously going to do. I mean, I just had two it's crucial points. I want to make sure it gets emphasized. So if we can... and I'll make another point here as well. It's very important, everybody, to make sure, because it's being recorded, that everybody speaks into the microphone. I thought I was speaking too much into it, but maybe if folks lean in as much as I am, I guess that'll help, since this is being recorded, and thankfully it is. But obviously, there's so many hands going up. I actually think you guys are actually much more important than I am. But two very important areas I definitely want to get in with these folks. Sharon, obviously a very challenging time for media. Buyouts, cutbacks, cutouts, all sorts of stuff going on right now in this changing media landscape. Is what Byron said basically inevitable? I mean, you were obviously in mainstream newsrooms at CNN and NBC News. Is that where this is all going anyway, where folks who are losing their jobs in mainstream media are going to have to start creating their own?
People aren't only losing their jobs. Black people are losing their jobs in droves. These newsrooms, Tribune, a number, and Eric, you know this to be the case, that they're losing their jobs, and not everybody's going to start their own publication, their own vehicle to take up what they left at their job. That not everybody's cut out to be an entrepreneur or some. So where are they going to go? They can go to platforms that can deliver some of these stories. And I have to piggyback on what Byron said and what Lauren did mention. The resources are absolutely necessary to produce the quality pieces. there's research, there's fact check, there's all kinds of things that go into producing stories. What we don't need is a bunch of misinformation, because we have enough of that. We don't need an abundance of pop and culture. We have enough of that. Not to say we can't have any more, it's just we don't need any more gossip. We need more places where people, I do like those, it's not like I'm dismissing them. We need more places that it requires a level of journalistic or news and information principles to get these stories out. And just to put this in context, the numbers of black publications that used to tell these stories, that used to deliver these stories, has declined immensely. I don't have the raw numbers, but they've declined. Mm-hmm. And these used to be the vehicles that used to tell these stories, these nuanced stories. And so if we can't have the discussion unless we're also going to have the discussion of resources. And that's really for all, you know, I wear two hats. I work for the Association of Black Foundation Executives, and I also, so I come with two perspectives in this. And if I can say to grant makers, to foundations, some do better than others, but for those who may be a little wary and just not sure, if there's a will, there is a way to help fund some of these most urgent platforms that really could use these resources. So that's, but people are losing their jobs, to answer your question, and sure, they got to go somewhere.
Rashad, let me bring you in on one of the big news stories of happening right now, really, and that is gay marriage, Proposition 8 out in California. We see what's happening out there. Now, every time I see a news story, at least on television, I typically don't see young men or old men or middle-aged men of color, black men specifically, who are homosexual, talking about their relationships and how civil marriage versus gay marriage and Proposition 8, how that impacts their lives. Obviously, you do a lot of work as far as trying to book people and trying to get on television yourself. Why is that? Is that because of the own stigmatization in our community of people of color who are gay and, you know, the uncomfortability there as far as coming out and being prominent in public? Or is that just a, you know, problem of us in the media not listening and being aware that there are people who are obviously gay in our community?
I mean, I think it's a mixed bag. You know, coming out is a tremendously tough process, and you know, I have worked with and counseled many amazing potential spokespeople who I would love to, you know, put before a camera and have talk about their stories and their lives and their relationships, and you know, they just simply cannot get over the hurdle of having to kind of go back home afterwards or go back to their church community and having to kind of wear the two hats and kind of walk with the two souls that you have to walk with as you know, a gay person who's African American or an African American who's a gay person, and you can't, and it's, you know, deciding which one you're going to be on any given day is deciding whether or not you need your left foot or your right foot, because it is you know, a complete part of your soul and who you are. And so you know, I have counseled and worked with, and I've also worked with, you know, media elite to kind of see the importance of including more straight African-American allies in the news, and they just cannot get past that. You know, I don't think it's just about having more, you know, gay folks talking about these stories. I do think that it's incredibly important that we see straight African-American men talking about these stories, talking about this openly and talking to their sons and talking to their daughters about these stories, because that is going to be part of the education that needs to happen. And so, yes, I do think it's incredibly important. As someone who worked on Proposition 8 and sat in the room when the, you know, and argued and when the decision was made that, you know, African-American votes couldn't be won, and that the decision needed to be to, you know, change course and go focus someplace else, and feeling like that was a mistake, but also seeing the focus group numbers and the numbers that came out of the polls and realizing that in 90 days you don't really change people's hearts and minds. We have work to do in our community, and that doesn't just mean that it's about gay people coming out. It's about straight people understanding that they have a responsibility to be the type of allies that make it easier in our community for people to feel like they can be out and proud of who they are, and they can go back in their communities and be accepted.
Let me just finally go to the final area, at least from me and Byron and Jordan, you're up next, and then I'll go to all of you out in the audience, as many questions as we can possibly take. Byron, you gave us some breaking news, as I told you when I first saw you today, because you wrote a letter to Deborah Lee. For those who don't know, Deborah Lee, of course, the president and CEO of Black Enterprise Television. Just by a show of hands, who saw the award show for BET Awards? Okay, good to good amount there. There was supposed to be a tribute to Michael Jackson. Byron, I made it through the first hour, and so I missed Lil Wayne and Drake. And this is somebody who, you know, I'm no elitist. I certainly love hip hop. I think Rough Ends No More is a pretty good dance tune. So that's a pretty good statement of where I am with hip hop. But what happened there with that? Obviously, you showed that you can be proactive. Now, BET issued an apology. One, what did you think of the apology? I wonder if you accepted it. And two, where do we go from here with BET? It's been in this with BET for a good 15 years now.
Can you tell us what your letter said?
My letter said, basically, dear BET, your award show was whack, basically, is what it said. Well, let me just talk about how the whole letter came to be. Earlier in the day, which was, I think, a Monday, BET show aired on Sunday night, last Sunday night. Monday morning, I went to a conference called Engaging Men on Violence Against Women. And it was a very thought-provoking conference for me. Because there were several women in the room who were really grappling with the reasons why so many men remain silent around sexism and sexual assault, all forms of violence against women. And so, you know, I've been doing work, people who know the work that I do, I've been doing a lot of work around those issues for many years now. But the question that one of the women posed in that conference just really struck me. I mean, she just really, really could not wrap her head around the fact that so many men just remain silent. Don't say anything. Do not confront, you know, patriarchy or sexism in any way, shape, or form or fashion. And so I went back to my hotel room, and I was thinking about the BET Awards, and I was seeing all of these postings on Facebook about how people were really disappointed with it, how upset they were about it, and that sort of thing. And I just took out my computer, and I just started writing a letter, you know, and it was partially inspired by being in that meeting, you know, early in that morning, but also my wife had also written a letter, and I followed her lead in writing a letter. And just, you know, it's all about realizing how much power you actually have, or at least feeling empowered, feeling like your voice matters. And I think a lot of people feel disempowered. I think a lot of people feel like their voice does not matter if they write a letter, if they speak out, if they try to confront the powers that be, that nobody's going to listen to them. And I just think what happened was my letter spoke to what a lot of people were thinking and feeling, and it resonated with a lot of people around the country, and I was overwhelmed with the amount of responses that I received from the letter on Facebook and on the internet. And I'm still receiving a lot of responses. And most people are saying that they agree that that BET does not necessarily represent African Americans in the way that they would like to be represented. So it was just me trying to live up to my own best self and being proactive, and just using my voice, basically.
And quickly, do you accept their apology?
No, I don't, because I think that I don't think it's a real. I'd have to see evidence that they are seriously addressing, you know, not just the BET Awards, but the decades, the volumes of images, of representations of people of color that they have projected to the universe, not just the United States of America, but around the world. So, I mean, I think it was an apology that acknowledged that, you know, people were unhappy about it, but I think that it's going to take a whole lot more than that than for BET to really show that they're really contrite about the representations of Black people that they project all over the world.
And Jordan, let me get to you before going to the audience. Programming executives rub their fingers in executive suites, thinking about you. They never met you, but folks that are advertisers, folks who are programmers, think about how to cater their programming to you. And first of all, do you watch BET?
Yes, I watch BET all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to say one thing, that the media is an extremely important thing. I learned that firsthand because my mom, Christina Coleman, is a reporter for the Daily News. She has been a reporter for 15 years for the Daily News. She's been a reporter for over 20-something. It was a long time. I don't remember. But I went with her to all these different stories, from the O.J. Simpson to Biggie to Amadou Diallo to Alan Newton. I went all over the place with her, and I saw how she got past the yellow tape, or she got past all the security guards to get to where she needs to go, and how African-American boys are usually the victims or the criminals in these different cases. And just like, it's a bad reputation for us, and how on TV it's not getting better, and I think it's just time for a change. And I think that from the shows that I watched, or when I used to watch when I was little, Under One Roof or The Flavor of Love, I think it's just time for a change. Yeah. Jerry Springer and the Maury shows, where they're irresponsible black African-American males saying they are not the baby daddies, it's just time for a change. And for the news reporters and all the cameramen who go out of their way to identify a black male as a criminal, when a white male does a crime, he calls him a suspect. I just think it's time for change. And with all due respect, BET, I think it's time for a change.
Well, let me ask you let me ask you a very quick follow-up, because I grew up on, you know, Family Ties and Different Strokes. And I mean, the beginning of your video there, of the Say It Loud film, shows you at home there with the friends playing video games.
Yes.
And we know that that hour of 2, 3 o'clock when kids are coming home and what they're exposed to, you know, the worst I could have seen back in the day with General Hospital, you, of course, with cable, are exposed to so much more. Now, there's a debate here as to whether it's the responsibility of the parents to make sure that the cable box may not even be in existence in the home, or if it's the programmers who are putting this stuff out. Who do you as a young person put more of the blame on?
I blame the parents.
Okay, enough said. let's look out into the audience and look at some hands of folks, and I'm going to be a little more conscious too of some of the folks at this OSI group as to how many questions we can take, but let us start with you, sir.
Appreciate it. Carl Carter, GTM. Sort of a reoccurring thing I'm hearing is the lack of our own voice in the media. And I guess for those that work in media, both, you know, Sharon and Eric, specifically, how big a role do you feel like the lack of diversity inside these companies has played in the way that our stories are treated? I think that's an issue that doesn't get addressed a lot. You know, our own lack of representation inside the newsrooms, inside of ownership, inside of management, on and on. And if you could kind of highlight that for me, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Brother Eric, I got this. Okay. it does impact tremendously. That is the headline. It is a headline. And having worked most recently in CNN Financial News when it was still on air, I don't, if you've ever walked, it's just this massive open space, very beautiful space over at Time Warner Center. But if you do a complete turn, if you just walk in and turn around, you will see just this absence of people of color working in that newsroom. I don't know if it's changed in the last, you know, since then. And that does inform the information that the viewing public receives. And it's not always malicious, but I do say you have to work really hard in New York City to come up with a workplace that looks like that. This is one of the most diverse places in the world, not the most inclusive, but it is diverse. So the pool is there. So when I go into editorial meetings, and I wasn't kidding earlier, it's not that I would be pitching that newsstand story at a financial, you know, it's not that, at a financial medium, but when you talk about the mortgage crisis, when you talk about the subprime crisis, when you talk about Chicago and the amount of murders that go on in that city, and it hasn't reached a level, a high-pitched level where something is dreadfully wrong. And the amount of people that are, that's because if you don't identify, and Eric may have a different perspective on this, But there, you, even reporters are human beings, and there is a certain, I would get upset if that's a news story that hasn't been covered. I inform that. So if it's not, if people of color, women, men, are not represented in a certain area, then that's not the story that's going to be delivered. And how it's delivered is all, I mean, it may, my best example, for instance, is at CNN Financial News, during the very, very beginnings of the subprime mortgage conflict, we had an intern who was assigned to go talk to a woman who was caught up in the subprime mortgage in Brooklyn. And a young intern at CNN, they didn't pay their interns. They're not unique. This is across the board. So if you can't afford to spend a summer working for free, then you're just not going to get your training. So she came back. She did some field producing. She came back and she said, the question was, how old do you think the woman is? Well, you know, she's got to be about 28 because my brother bought his first house at 28. Well, if that's what's informing your, this woman was in her late 30s, and she was a black woman. But if that's, you know, if you're from Mount Kisco, and you're, you know, this is how you grow up, then that does inform. And of course, we corrected her. But let's say there were no corrections. So I do believe that diversity is an absolute necessity, in whether it's mainstream, wherever it is, and the information that's received. So.
I think more importantly than diversity is the kind of diversity. You know, I think that, yeah. You know.
Well, inclusion.
Yes.
Well, inclusion, and also, you know, there are a lot of diverse areas, but if folk aren't willing to say what needs to be
exactly.
said and have the influence
exactly.
that needs to be not just numbers. But also the influence, and that's across the board, whether it's in media or philanthropy or what have you.
There's a kind of class diversity, too.
Class diversity.
It's all going to be Yale Law School graduates, whether black or white, they're going to have similar perspectives.
Absolutely.
Eric, you don't forget to speak into the microphone. I imagine everybody wants to hear your wonderful voice.
I'm just saying an issue of class diversity, too, although I have to say, of course, it makes a huge difference, and the Times, like other papers, has made pretty serious efforts, I would say, over the last 20, 30 years to diversify the workforce, and it's often brought some very positive results with young reporters of different backgrounds bringing in different kinds of stories and being able to cover stories with a familiar community. There has not been as much progress at the senior editorial levels for various reasons. And that's where the signals, the body language, gets sent to the rest of us, you know, what's good and bad. So there's some ways to go.
We'll go with the microphone for somebody else who has a question. Okay.
I think the next person back here.
Oh, great.
I'm going to be a Sally Jesse for a little bit and be passing the mic.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm going to try to be as quickly as possible. It's really a comment. My name is Tracy Munford. I'm a communications director for the Community Service Society of New York. And I want to say a couple things real quickly. There are 2 million young men and women in New York who we've kind of identified as disconnected youth, primarily black and Hispanic. Nationwide, there are 6 million. Now, for CSS, for over 200 years, we've been talking about poverty. It is so important what we're talking about today that we have shifted our focus to also include disconnected youth. And sometimes planting the seed. 3 years ago, we met with Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, Senator Edwards. No Republicans would come. We met with them individually and said, guess what? What are you going to do for poverty? What are you going to do for black and Hispanic young and men and women, disconnected youth? We took that to create a national platform that we now do for over 2 years in Washington called Working for Change. And one of our primary speakers, Linda Harris, is here, and it's great to see her. Out of that program, for 2 years, every month, under the auspices of Congressman Rangel, we meet on Capitol Hill to talk about this issue. What has come of it over 2 years, and it took almost 2 years, is that Congressman Rangel included a bill in the stimulus package that now will result in young men and women, disconnected youth, getting jobs. That is part of the stimulus package. Congressman Nadler just introduced the bill 2497. These young men and women nationwide, but primarily we're fighting for young people in New York, they, under Bill 2497, will be included in the infrastructure and the rebuilding of America. Now, this story is so important nationally. I mean, it is a crisis that the Community Service Society has had to take what we do and expand and take our pennies here and there, and something we have a decent amount of money, but we've had to do a combination of paid media and other media. I have to thank Esther, I have to thank Ron, I have to thank Eric, because 2 months after I started working at the Community Service Society, after working in New Jersey for 20 years, Eric had a front page story that included David Jones and talked about poverty and young men. In fact, you've probably helped me to keep my job. Thank you all. But I say that because not only have we had to do a combination of different media and unpaid media, but we've also had to do paid media. So David Jones does a column every 2 weeks in the Amsterdam News. We just started a year ago a column every 2 weeks in El Diario. And now, as of 3 weeks ago, he is now in Huffington Post every week. He's going to be in American Prospect magazine, which is national magazine, in another month. But I'm saying all this because the mainstream media just will not cover it. Byron, I mean, everybody up there has it exactly right. They will not cover it. We do have people like Eric, Ron, and Esther, and others who will, but you really have to take a combination and get some of your pennies together. The stories have to be told in order to affect national change and create national policy, and that's the only way we're going to get something done with these young people. Thank you.
Get someone on this side of the room. How about you?
Hi, I'm Lola Adeshoye, and I'm deputy editor at thegrio.com, which is a new African-American news site. And my point is that I'm a writer. I write for mainstream publications. The Grio is a co-venture with NBC News, and I think that we can use the mainstream media in some ways to our advantage. So we have a group of black people, you know, and some white people too, working, you know, on stories that affect us within a mainstream organization, but we're also independent. So I do think that whilst the mainstream isn't necessarily representative, we can't demonize the mainstream. I think there are ways that we could try and find to work along with the mainstream and find our voices there as well. But my other point as well is that, you know, diversity is good, but as BET shows, diversity itself doesn't actually mean anything. So it's not just having people, it's having progressive voices, it's having people that actually care and actually want to make a difference. And so I just don't see the point of having more black people if they're not going to progress the conversation. So that's
good point. And let me just point out too, as more hands raised and the microphone will pass around, thank you for that point, Lola, as well. Let's, as we ask those questions, if we keep it moderately short, and let's continue. Go ahead.
I just wanted to speak to
and make it a question.
What this woman just said. I think, you know, I definitely think we should have to work with the system to, you know, work with mainstream media, work with whatever it is to, I guess, get that solve the larger problem. I think BET is a part of the problem. I think that entertainers, artists, we help control what we see. Like, we can say what we will and what not do, and it goes for the, you know, the Flavor of Love show that's on VH1. If Flavor Flav wouldn't agree to do something like this, or the women who wouldn't line up just to be on TV to do it, then we wouldn't see it. So I think that part of the issue is the companies that are pushing it and perpetuating it, but also I think it starts with the artists and what they will and would not do, what they're willing to make money for or whatever. So, yeah, okay. That's all I have to say.
All right. More questions?
Thank you. I'd like to slightly change the subject, if I may, please. I have a dream, which I know sounds familiar, and I'm sorry if I'm a little tongue-tied, but this is so incredibly important. If you listen to what all you guys were saying here today, it's all young, 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 young. If you substitute the word older worker for every time you said black or Latino or person of color, you would see that the discrimination is worse for the older worker, and it is completely ignored by corporate America, blatantly, even though there's a law on the books forbidding it. Nobody's willing to enforce it, including our own Attorney General here in New York. What my dream is that organizations like yours and philanthropies and NOW and the AARP and ReServe could get together, and instead of just concentrating on their own little areas, put something together to help this older... I'm of the generation that enabled you guys to be here today. I'm wearing a pin that Roy Innes gave me from the Congress of Racial Equality. We our generation was out there fighting to help you guys be as good as you can be today, and we're being discarded like so much dirty meat. We're told you don't have anything to offer us. We look at how we're represented in the media. I am definitely not a McCain fan, but I have to tell you, the sympathy that I had for the every night on every comedy show, the stuff that they said about him was all directed at his age. It had nothing to do with what his politics was. It was just he was old, and so forget him. Now, that he may have been completely disabled because of his age, I don't know. But I just think that that's a cheap shot. And talk about images in the media. Just look around. See what they say about older people. It's all a joke.
Well, you got to express yourself this morning, and we thank you for doing so.
Thank you. I hope you guys can help.
Indeed. We have 10 minutes, a hard 10 minutes, so preference for questions, and the shorter the better, if the microphone makes the rounds.
Just a real quick comment. Neil Irvin from Men Can Stop Rape in Washington, D.C., and I think just support so much of what has been said. I think one of the things on maybe the opposite side of the last comment for me is going back to working with images and the perceptions of young men and young women in the media. Jordan, one of the things I love about even hearing the voices of the work that you all have done with the Backyardigans is that for my children, it's one of the few places I found that we were able to allow them to watch it, be engaged, be creative, and help them create their own kind of play and imaging outside of the house, you know, not constantly watching the television. But in terms of the media makers that are here, I would like to see Backyardigans with actual people, right? To see these positive voices, these positive performances, this creative nature for young men and young women, adolescents, because I think when we talk about images and social norming and the behavior changes that we're looking at, and Lauren talking earlier about kind of the mindset that that creates, I think it becomes a great opportunity for the media makers to create environments and places where young people can feel empowered. You know, my daughter role plays having, you know, parties with Sasha and Malia. And it's a great opportunity now for us to build on that. And I just want to, you know, encourage everyone to think about ways in which these initiatives can put forth more images and really contribute to kind of the social norming that we're talking about changing.
Make a comment about that. I'm 100% with all of these great ideas, but there's just a reality to putting together, and that reality is the resources that it takes to put together a film, a short film, the writing that goes behind a story. I told, you know, I had the benefit of going to some New York Times training that was done through the New York Media Community Alliance, and it was a two-day. And I had a conversation with Eric before this started, that we are often one people, one person shops. So it's not that we don't want to do this, but there is just a reality to all of this. And I think that OSI, they get that. But all of this takes an incredible amount of resources, and I don't mean the resources of an NBC or a major network, but it certainly takes some resources. Griot, by the grace of God, and some good, you know, some good resources, has been able to launch a site that does some really good work. TheRoot.com is partnering with the Washington Post to be able to. It's able to produce that and hire writers and all of that. You know, I can't ask journalists that get paid unless they're my friend and they're willing to just, you know, toss me some of their time or their talent. But it pains me to call and say, can you toss us a story on this? And they do it, but they need to get paid. So there's just the reality of that. Just wanted.
Right. Got time for about two more questions.
Gentleman in the back here, we're going to do Frank Miles from the Clinton Foundation, and then this young man had a question back here.
Right.
I'm sort of being put on the spot here, but I guess my question for the panel, and I don't want to keep reiterating this point, but I have a lot of friends that are school teachers, and so in the city, and how President Obama's sort of that has sort of galvanized a lot of the students and just sort of changed their perceptions about a lot. What are we doing concretely to sort of help those young people become not just, let's say, President of the United States, but President of Paramount, that, you know, makes, or being in their room, President of Condé Nast, that sort of thing, that changes, you know, let's say that people have heard about the Transformers movie and that incident's there. If not, please look up that up, or LeBron on the cover of Vogue. What are some concrete steps from the panel that we can do to start putting those people in the room? Because it's interesting how we can have a president of the United States, but we don't have a president that's black who's of Miramax or Condé Nast. It's almost hysterical. So I'd like to bring that up to the panel.
Rashad and Byron?
I think that part of this does root back to, you know, the fact of, you know, of structural and de facto racism that exists in the media world and exists everywhere else in society, you know, and part of this also roots back to the corporate consolidation of media. I mean, five companies own everything. And so I know that we're having conversations about what's on BET or what's on, you know, CNN or what's on over here. But, you know, as a person who works with the media to try to get folks to do things better, I have to walk into three or four buildings and I can go to different floors and talk to what is supposed to be kind of completely different institutions. And so I think that, you know, part of kind of, you know, the ladder that, you know, that folks in our community have to climb in order to move up along the ladder is oftentimes, you know, kind of has all these pitfalls and, you know, kind of broken rungs that are, you know, rooted in kind of, you know, corporate consolidation, are rooted in, you know, the fact that so few people really do get the opportunity. And so I think that it is about education, and I think that's incredibly important, but I don't think that you can just tell young people to get your education and everything will be fine. And I think that we, you know, from kind of, you know, the folks who do advocacy work, from the folks that do, you know, work in the foundation world, I do think that it's really about us pushing to change how institutions are run and how the world looks, because we can, you know, empower all these young people to do the things that they're supposed to do, and then we're still feeding them into a world and into a culture that's not going to have the type of opportunities for them once they get there.
And let me make a quick point before we go to the final question, because, you know, we have an example right here with Jordan. And I know Byron does this work as well, which is really directly engaging young people in the classrooms. You know, I go into the classrooms very often to talk to young people. You know, I meet young people who say, hey, you know, I want to spit rhymes. That's my dream. You know, and talking to them directly, one-on-one, about what that means, how that, you know, what that really means, ultimately. So I think it requires that direct engagement. And Jordan, who goes directly into the classrooms and talks to young people at his level, is doing, who knows, you're planting seeds for a future Jordan Coleman. You want to be a sports journalist, but really you already are a journalist. We can speak things into power, and you already are a journalist. So thank you for your work.
Also, can I say one thing?
Yeah.
Give a shout out.
From showing my film at different schools and churches, kids from ages 4 to like 10, they look up to me and they say that they want to be just like me because I play sports. I play football, basketball, and baseball. I've been making honor roll in every marking period from elementary school and in middle school. So I'm a scholar in it. Thank you.
You're going to be on Doritos, aren't you? The
yes.
Doritos bags?
I'm going to be on 40 million bags of Doritos with my story on it. So while you guys licking your fingers, you can read about me.
Jordan, is your mother here?
Yes. She's
where is
right
she?
Up here in front.
We need to just shake her hand.
Right. Yeah. That's how it starts, with the direct engagement, and so often it starts in the home as well as the classroom. I think we had one more question, right, in the back?
My name is James Jordan. I have a question for Jordan. What inspired you to become a film director to help little kids like the Black audience?
My mom actually inspired me to do well in school, to do everything, because she knows how hard it is for black males like you and me out there in the real life. So she wants us to make sure that we're doing the right thing and that we have positive things to do. Because I remember when I was little, there was a show called Power Rangers on. And my mom would not let me watch Power Rangers because she said that I would go up and start hitting people and then she would have to hit me and then that would be a whole different story. But But after that, I was wondering why were there restrictions on TV shows? But then once I started growing up and Simpsons and Family Guy and SpongeBob came on, I started to realize why there's restriction on TV shows for little kids. And now I'm working on a TV show. I'm trying to fund money for a TV show so I can make a positive TV show for little kids and for teenagers so they have something to watch without their parents thinking twice about what they should watch on TV.
But SpongeBob is a kid show, but Family Guy is like crazy stuff, nasty things.
That's true, but it has hidden meanings to it, and you think it's a kid show until you understand what's going on.
Well,
you're welcome.
What a pleasure and honor and to be here. It wasn't off the wall, but it was close enough. What a fantastic all-star panel that we were exposed to today. I know, as I said, we literally had 50 million questions that we could pose to them. We did run a little bit over, of course, and great appreciation for all of your time here and to talk about it with folks. But before we, I guess, officially thank the panel, I know we are going to be going back to Sean Dove for some final thoughts and impressions. But for all the folks here, thank you so much for being here today.
And let's give Curtis an amazing round of applause. He did a fantastic job. And the time is short, and as I said when we began, that this is not just an event, this is a part of a strategy, and our commitment with the Open Society's campaign for Black Male Achievement is to keep you engaged, keep this conversation going. We're committing to continue to convene, to continue to partner, to continue to invest resources, Sharon, where it is needed, and to continue to lead around this this area. In the last 5 minutes, we have two words. One word will come from Reverend Alfonso Wyatt, who is the chair of the 21st Century Foundation, the producers of A-Game, which we talked about earlier. And then the final word will come from FM Supreme. Correct? So we're going to ask Reverend Alfonso Wyatt, and we're going to do all that in 5 minutes. I know that's like going to be miraculous, to come up, say a word to close us out, and then introduce FM Supreme, who will have the final spoken word. And we want to thank you for coming out for this powerful, powerful panel, a panel that we could probably have done all day, and we will continue to be in touch with you. Thank you. Reverend Wyatt?
Thank you, Sean, and thank you all who gave up pretty much now a day to be together. But I think that there is such power in this room that we would be remiss if you walked out of this room and did not meet at least 7 or 8 folk that we can begin to network with. I met Jordan and his mom. They came to my office, and while I didn't have money to produce them, I did have social currency to introduce them. I like that.
Me too.
I'm setting you up, FM. I'm setting you up. So there are things that we can do within the currency of our being if we so think that way. Because so a man or woman thinks, so do they do. And as one that represents the same generation, my sister, that you're talking about, this should never be, there should never be a shibboleth. There should never be a gap that because you are a certain age that you can not relate to one another. You know, I love hip hop. I love to watch it. I love to think I could do it. But in a sense, that's what I do. Because all I'm doing is taking ideas and words and taking the spoken and the oral tradition. I'm setting you up, FM. I'm setting you up. Where'd the FM go? Where's the, over there. All right. I'm sorry, Deja. That's true. I did know that. So there we go. So this young brother, the question that young brother asked in the back is really the reason why we're here. Because I believe that we have opportunity to use our status, to use our intelligence, to use our spirit, to make sure that something greater, that the whole can indeed be greater than the sum of its parts. As one who has served as a mentor for many of the folk who are in this room, all we do is plant seeds as we go forward. We started off this day talking about perception and the power of perception. Let me give you one of my earliest thoughts about perception when I was about Jordan's age, or maybe a little bit younger. I looked at a rat, and I looked at a squirrel. And I said, they look alike, but they have different reactions in people. I discovered that in my mind that the rat and the squirrel had different public relation firms. You got to find a way to take complicated stuff and make it make sense. And if we are going to ride the zeitgeist of where we are, that great spirit and power, then we've got to understand the difference between those two PR firms. I close with, and I appreciate Fenton, I appreciate the work that you do, but at this advanced age, as a leader in this country, I still generate fear. I can't run after nobody. I would probably give my life for anybody that was in danger because that's how I'm wired. But yet, the bondage, the sheer pain of being written off before you open your mouth, of being feared or minimized or ridiculed in many instances, sometimes not to your face, is something that hurts. 10 days, you can deal with it. Maybe the 11th day, you flip. So all I'm saying is that we have a work to do. It is so good. I've been in this room. This is my fourth time. I've been in this room before Sean and his crew came here. But I've never, ever, never, never seen what is going on. I'm vice president of the Fund for the City of New York, as well as chair of the 21st Century Foundation. But what happens and what has been happening in this room has been culturally right on point and on target. So with that said, it is my honor, my duty, my pleasure to bring the griot, the one that God has given the gift to use the words as a way to hypnotically bind those who are trying to get away but want to come together because they want to stay together. She's going to use her gift to take the spirit and to take the mind higher all the way from the Windy City. Look what the wind blew in. Come on, daughter. Come on and hit it up. Hit it up.
First and foremost, I just want to, you know, I want to make it really fast. Like, we got to thank God, you know what I'm saying, for being here. Deja and I, you know, just what we've been through in life, and like, we're 20 years old, and we're not supposed to be here right now in this room, engaging in this amazing panel, listening to what's going on. I actually went to Marymount Manhattan College for a year, and my professor, Dr. Janice Kelly, was here, who's in the back. Make some noise for Dr. Janice Kelly. Like, I've been through so much, and I've always kept in contact with this woman, and I forgot to tell her that I'd be in New York, and by fate, she's here. She's my communications professor. I was a communications major. So it's like, everything happens for a reason. I want to thank OSI, Rashid Shabazz, Adam Coldbreath, Christina Voigt, just everybody, and we can just go. This is a movement. We're going to keep moving, and we ain't going to stop because it's Commonwealth. And this is funny because the first time I used to like perform in front of like a panel like that, it can go. I was in Dr. Janice's class doing a presentation. Can you turn the music a little bit? Yo, it's Commonwealth. It's Commonwealth. I said, this is the movement. This is the movement. This is the movement. So start moving. This is the movement. This is the movement. This is the movement. I don't see y'all moving. This is the movement. Something like Asada and Sean Carter supreme. My clip hair sharper than Barbara's. I'm Obama with the vote, but Osama with all the haters. I get half them lanes as I smoke them like my vapors. I'm struggling to wake up at the office, wear my makeup. I'm trying to stack my cake up, but the job is making pay cuts.
But I evolved from all of that. A proud black woman rocking hats, so forget all that. To the child, I bring it back to the drawing board, hotter than an asteroid. These old school dudes spitting like they dinosaurs. These new school dudes need to bow down and kiss the floor. Supreme, and I'm coming, fighting against a cancer war. Dancing with the angry poor people that I represent. I'm not the Messiah, but FM, yo, I'm heaven sent. You can smell my estrogen. These dudes are irrelevant. Young, black, and militant. I am God's instrument. If you don't get it, then I won't spell it out. These East Coast dudes think I'm from that dirty South, but I'm from that Midwest. I know we're about to drought, but I just seen more tears than Katrina in my house. Yeah, this is a movement. This is a movement. This is a movement. So start moving. This is a movement. This is a movement. This is a movement. I don't see y'all moving. This is a movement. This is a movement. This is a movement. So start moving. This is a movement. This is a movement. Yeah, yeah. Just dreaming about the movement, Malcolm X and Huey Newton. Black power in my veins and my brain, so I just use it. Clueless MCs forgetting that the goal is more than music. Born in the diaspora, my natural hair, it just proven I'm a monarch. These silly cats are pop tarts. Sign contracts to debt, now tell me who's the retard. Regard the female MC who falls last in society. But we are thoroughbred, just study the dichotomy. Work hard, feed the kids, barely make them dividends. The Muslims, them Christians claim religion just to blend in. So I step in, about to reclaim my throne. This FM Supreme, I'm bound to take it home. Like Jane Addams did, like the Queen MC Light. Hands off Asada, all I need is one mic to fist fight. All the drama, just save it. A young Angela Davis, eat the gumbo with basics. This game, I'm about to change it. This is a movement. This is a movement. This is a movement. So start moving. This is a movement. This is a movement. This is a movement. I don't see y'all moving. Thank y'all.
Thank you. We will be in touch. Thank you all for coming out. And just one final props and round of applause for Rashid Shabazz and his leadership, and Robert Ramirez at Fenton. Thank you.